No, I have not. No, I have not signed a pledge with the Koch brothers. And again, this is so much misinformation that's coming from Harry Reid's Senate Majority PAC, from extreme environmentalist Tom Steyer from California, and coming from the congressman's own campaign. Is I have not signed a pledge with the Koch brothers. And matter of fact, I have been outspent from outside money coming into the state of Iowa by about $2 million. So I take issue with that, and that's misinformation.
Congressman Braley, the same sort of question for you. Is this part of a Democratic strategy to frame Republicans across the country in aligning them with a multi-billion-dollar corporation?
Well, I think, Senator Ernst, you have signed pledges. You've signed pledges with a group called Club for Growth. And the truth is you attended two secret donor meetings in California that were hosted by the Koch brothers. You called them wonderful at that meeting. You credited them with launching your Senate campaign. And these are the same Koch brothers who have seven different organizations attacking me right now in Iowa. Seven. They are big oil interests. They are working to try to kill the wind energy tax credit that Senator Grassley and I both championed. They're trying to repeal the renewable fuel standard that's going to devastate Iowa farmers. They oppose the farm bill. So these are the biggest supporters you have in your campaign right now. And it's a fair criticism to ask about how they're supporting you in this election.
15 seconds.
Yes. Again, this is from someone that's being supported by a California billionaire extreme environmentalist who opposes the Keystone Pipeline, which then the congressman flip-flopped on that issue. So, yes, I have signed a taxpayer protection pledge so that anybody that is paying taxes can keep more of those dollars in their pockets. I support those hardworking Iowa families out there that wish to make the decisions what to do with their own money, not the federal government.
And 15 seconds for you, Congressman.
Gary, I stand with Iowans who want secret donor money out of politics forever. I think it's the worst thing that's happened to our democracy. That's why I supported the Disclose Act that would require transparency and accountability for these secret donors. And I call on you to join me right now, Senator Ernst, in committing to telling all of these outside groups to take these ads down and let Iowans decide this election.
And
15 seconds, please.
Yes, and there are probably reforms that could be made, but again, I am being outspent by $2 million from these very organizations that are supporting Congressman Braley. So here he is calling for reform, and yet we're being tremendously outspent on the airwaves by these outside organizations.
We've exhausted this issue. I believe we have much more to talk about. We're going to take a short break. Decision 2014 Senate debate will continue after this.
Thank you. Thank you.
As you just heard, they're taking a short break in Davenport, Iowa, and will return to their live Senate debate in a couple of minutes. C-SPAN's Campaign 2014 is bringing you more than 100 debates for the control of Congress. Stay in touch with our coverage and engage. Follow us on Twitter at C-SPAN and like us at facebook.com/C-SPAN. And our campaign coverage continues tomorrow with live coverage of a debate in the Michigan's governor's race. Incumbent Republican Governor Rick Snyder faces Democrat Mark Schauer. That's live at 6 p.m. Eastern on C-SPAN.
Be part of C-SPAN's Campaign 2014 coverage. Follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook to get debate schedules, video clips of key moments, debate previews from our politics team. C-SPAN is bringing you over 100 Senate, House, and Governor debates, and you can instantly share your reactions to what the candidates are saying. The battle for control of Congress. Stay in touch and engage by following us on Twitter at C-SPAN and liking us on Facebook at facebook.com/C-SPAN.
C-SPAN's 2015 Student Cam competition is underway. This nationwide competition for middle and high school students will award 150 prizes totaling $100,000. Create a 5 to 7 minute documentary on the topic, The Three Branches and You. Videos need to include C-SPAN programming, show varying points of view, and must be submitted by January 20th, 2015. Go to studentcam.org for more information. Grab a camera and get started today.
Now, our continuing campaign 2014 coverage continues with more of the debate for the Iowa U.S. Senate seat. Current Senator Tom Harkin is retiring after serving 5 terms, and both the Cook and Rothenberg political reports list this race as a toss-up. This is live coverage on C-SPAN.
From social media, this question will be for Joni Ernst. 1 minute, please, to respond to this Facebook question from Bobby Carson. From the heart, how do you feel our country is doing? Do you recognize the desperation and concern that the American people have?
Well, thank you, Bobby. This is the reason that I am running for United States Senate, is because I do believe that our country is going in the wrong direction. This is Washington, D.C. ways, records of failure coming from this administration and followers like Congressman Braley, versus our Iowa values and the way we have conducted business in the past 4 years. With my good supporter, Terry Branstad, we have implemented strong economic policy here in Iowa, lower taxes, reduced job-killing rules and regulations, and a balanced budget. And we are putting more of our hardworking Iowans back to work with new, good-paying jobs. Iowa has the 4th fastest growing personal income in the United States, while nationally, the real wage has decreased over the past 8 years that Congressman Braley has been there by 2.7%. So, yes, we are going in the wrong direction, and that's why I'm running.
Congressman Braley, 1 minute, please.
Well, Senator Ernst is forgetting that we came through the greatest economic crisis since the Great Depression. That was handed over to the president when he took office. We've seen one of the largest continued segments of private sector growth in the history of this country. But the question is, how is our country doing? Well, if you're one of the Koch brothers, it's going pretty well right now. But the problem is, for too many Iowans, the economy recovery hasn't impacted their lives in a meaningful way. That's why I stand with 300,000 Iowans who deserve a pay raise by increasing the minimum wage. 60% of those Iowans are women. 50% of them are over the age of 30. And we need to make sure that the economy is working for them. That's why we also need to start reinvesting and rebuilding our aging infrastructure. We need to revitalize our manufacturing base, and that's why I spoke to the Iowa Association of Business and Industries, private advanced manufacturing conference this week, sharing my ideas on what we can do to improve Iowa's economy.
Thank you. Now on to the topic of foreign policy. We have a lot going on in the world, from the Ebola crisis to ISIS. We begin our questioning in this discussion with James Lynch from the Cedar Rapids Gazette. The first question will be for Senator Ernst.
We have a frightening situation in the Mideast with the rise of the Islamic State holding large areas in Iraq and Syria, terrorizing and killing people there, including other Muslims. And President Obama has formed a coalition to fight ISIS and has told the nation that he's not willing to commit U.S. ground troops to that fight. Senator Ernst, you recently wrote that airstrikes might not be enough, and you've had your boots on the ground in the Mideast. Under what conditions would you vote to send Iowa soldiers back to the Mideast?
Right. Thank you, James. And yes, I have served in the Middle East, and I did have my boots on that ground. And ISIS must be stopped. They are an extreme terrorist organization that is killing innocent civilians, including Americans. And because I have had my boots on that ground and I have led Iowa's sons and daughters, I take this issue very seriously. I have a number of criteria that I would look at before committing any additional military actions. The first is there actionable intelligence and does it pose a threat to us, and will our actions wipe out that threat? Second is there a clearly defined mission, and are we willing to put the resources towards that mission? And then finally, are we going to care for our servicemen and women with a withdrawal plan, making sure that they are cared for when they get home and also taking care of their families? Those are the things that I would have to consider.
Representative Braley, you've consistently opposed open-ended commitments of U.S. troops. And I ask you the same question. Under what conditions would you vote to send U.S. troops into the Mideast?
Well, first of all, James, I think Congress should go back into session and have a broader and longer conversation about the nature of our involvement and making sure that the president knows under what conditions he has authority to commit U.S. ground forces. I agree with Senator Ernst on the conditions that should be considered as part of that decision, but I also think there are two important things missing. And these are from General Colin Powell's analysis of the same problem. You have to convince the American people that this is worth the investment of blood and treasure. That case hasn't been made yet. And you also have to make sure that you're addressing the problem in the region, because we have been informed by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs that there is no military solution that doesn't involve a political solution in Iraq and in Syria. I think we should go back into session. ISIS is a terrorist threat that has to be eliminated. People who attack Americans need to be brought to justice or to the grave.
Oh, may I respond?
15 seconds? Sure.
Yes, and I know the American public is very confused on this issue when it comes to Congressman Braley's response, because just earlier this year in June, after Mosul, the second largest city in Iraq, was taken by ISIS, he voted against funding any combat actions in Iraq. And yet now he's asking that Congress come back to reconsider that. I'm not sure where to go with that. And I know that he twice voted to defund our combat troops while they were serving in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Congressman Braley, 15 seconds.
Senator Ernst knows that that's not true. What I voted for was to end decade-long commitment of U.S. troops. And I made it very clear that I supported pay increases for those troops and was not going to defund them. And Senator Ernst also knows that the vote that she's talking about was a bipartisan vote where Republicans and Democrats had concerns about who we were going to be helping and what threat we were going to be addressing.
James, you had a follow-up question?
Well, Senator Ernst, you've said that you would have voted for the authorization to arm, train, and equip the Syrian opposition. And I'm wondering how confident you are that those arms won't be turned against us or our allies sometime in the future. Do we really know who we're supporting there?
I was not as confident a year ago when we were talking about arming Syrian rebels when there were issues in Syria. But we have had a year to carefully vet those moderate rebels. Now, that's part of this, is making sure that those arms aren't turned against us. Is there 100% assurance? No, there is not. But I do believe that we have to work with a coalition and bringing others into this fight before we commit ground troops from America's sons and daughters.
And Congressman Braley, how confident are you about who we're arming there? Or is this a case of the enemy of my enemy at the moment is my friend?
Well, James, one of the concerns that Republicans and Democrats shared when we were talking about this and voting on it was the fact that we spent over $30 billion to arm, train, and equip 950,000 members of the Iraqi Army, police force, and Border Patrol. And yet they were rolled up by 15,000 ISIS terrorists, and many of those weapons are now in the hands of those terrorists that American taxpayers paid for. So that's why we are very concerned about the vetting process. That's why I think we should go back into session, get an updated classified briefing on what's happened since we made that vote, because one of the things that we were insistent upon was that the vetting process be very thorough and that we're only supporting groups that are going to be supportive of balancing those airstrikes and making the type of gains we need to eliminate this terrorist threat.
15 seconds.
May I respond? Yes, we knew this threat was there months and months and months ago. And this decision could have been made earlier this year. So there's no sense in calling Congress back now when this decision could have been made several months ago. Now, if in 2011 the President, his administration, had listened to his senior military advisors and his Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, and actively pursued a status of forces agreement, left our troops there for a period of time to stabilize the region, we may not be in this circumstance now.
Thank you. Let's move on now to immigration. Ron has a question in, as regards to potentially amnesty as an executive order, among other things. His first question for Congressman Braley. 1 minute, please.
Yeah, and I'd like to have both of you answer this. But earlier this week, there were reports from U.S. border agents. They said at least 10 alleged ISIS fighters have been caught trying to cross the border of Mexico and Texas in our nation. Senator Ernst, what is your biggest concern that these U.S. borders are not secure enough? We know your position on the borders, but that terrorists like ISIS are taking advantage of this lapse, crossing over the United States, trying maybe perhaps to establish lives here for a while with their real intent then to attack us on our own soil later on.
And we begin with Mr. Braley on this question.
Sorry, excuse me, Gary. Congressman.
No, that's okay, Ron. Look, if we had passed the comprehensive immigration reform bill that the Senate passed with an overwhelming bipartisan vote, 68 senators, including Senator John McCain, who lives in Arizona, we would have added 20,000 new Border Patrol agents. It was a bipartisan vote that would have beefed up our border security and made us safer. But Senator Ernst says that she wouldn't support that bill. And if we brought that to the floor of the House right now, we could pass it and we would be safer. But the problem is too many people try to turn this into a political debate rather than to protecting the American people. And so they continue to resist efforts at comprehensive immigration reform, which I have been working for 8 years to try to pass. They use the word amnesty to drive a wedge between people, and they mislead Iowans about what amnesty is. Amnesty is when you break the law and there are no consequences. This bill would provide real tough penalties. You have to admit you broke the law, go to the back of the line. We need to pass immigration reform now.
Senator? Would you like to respond to that?
Thank you, Ron. Yes, this is an easy issue that should have been resolved a number of years ago. We have a porous border with people crossing as they wish. We should have secured this border long ago. And then second, we need to enforce the laws that exist on the books right now and then work long term to address legal immigration. We need to do that. But the congressman says he has been there for 8 years working on comprehensive reform, and yet I do believe there were 2 years where Democrats controlled the House, the Senate, and had the presidency that nothing was done. So we do need to focus on this issue, but I don't believe in amnesty, and that's really what this bill that the congressman supported would do. There are 5 million people out there that are applying for the legal immigration process. We shouldn't be putting others ahead of them.
Should I follow up, Ron?
Congressman, I think
Ron,
I'd say something.
Waiting for a long-term solution to immigration reform, as Senator Ernst just suggested, will not make U.S. citizens safer. Putting 20,000 more Border Patrol agents in the field by passing the Senate immigration bill with overwhelming bipartisan support and bringing it to the floor of the House for a vote to let Americans see where we stand on this issue will make us safer.
Senator Ernst, let me ask you this. If you're elected to the United States Senate, would you try to repeal DACA, the President's Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals? How do you feel about that?
I'm sorry, could you state that question again?
I said, if you're elected to the United States Senate, would you try to repeal DACA, the President's Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals?
No, I would not. No, I would not.
Is that working, Congressman?
Yes. I've talked to young people in Iowa who are using it to get a driver's license and get a job and be productive members of contributing to Iowa. And I've seen what it's done to give them hope and the opportunity to see a better future for themselves and their families. That's what the American dream is all about. That's why my ancestors came from Ireland during the potato famine, settled across the river in Coal Valley to start a better life for themselves. Then they moved to Iowa to start a farm. My great-great-grandfather died breaking the prairie. He is buried across the river. His wife moved there later and started that farm with her five children. That's what we want to do, is provide hope and opportunity to the next generation of Iowans who are going to make us a great state in the future.
And may I respond? And that's where we agree. Is there are a number of children that have been brought here not of their own accord. And I do support allowing those children some of the freedoms that are here in the United States. We are a country of immigrants, but we are also a nation of laws, which is why with a comprehensive immigration plan, I don't support the amnesty for those adults that knowingly come here when it is illegal to do so.
Thank you. And as we come towards the end of our debate, it is fitting to have the final question be from another viewer, this from William from KWQC.com. After many elections, I've found the people running for office keep telling how they are going to help the middle class. What is the middle class? Join ears.
I am the middle class. My husband, Gail, was laid off of his second shift job at a factory a number of years ago, and we were very fortunate. He did find another job. I live in a middle-class neighborhood. My husband and I bought our house for $80,000 in Red Oak, Iowa. It was a home that belonged to one of my childhood friends, and we still live there today. It's an average neighborhood. It is perfect Iowa out there. That's the middle class. We work hard for what we earn. We know the value of a dollar, and we want to protect our economy. That's what the middle class is.
Congressman Braley, 1 minute.
William, the middle class is the heart and soul of America. And it used to be policies were designed to strengthen and expand the middle class. That's why I started a caucus when I was first elected to Congress, to focus on economic policies that will strengthen and expand access to the middle class. That's what the American dream is all about. But there are too many people that are trying to take away opportunity from people in the middle class, the people I grew up with in Brooklyn, Iowa. When my dad had his accident at the grain elevator and was laid up for almost a year, those friends and neighbors came and helped us out and helped us through those tough times. But for too many Iowans, that is increasingly a distant dream. So that's why I support efforts to make college affordable for Iowans. And I have fought to expand Pell Grants and reduce the interest rates on student loans in half to make sure that Iowa students have a chance of living a middle-class existence and to reduce the debt that they have when they leave college. That's what the middle class is all about, hope and opportunity.
And we have time for one more, if we can keep this on for about 30 seconds each. KWQC Twitter, Hutch Hefner asks, is either candidate willing to tackle the police state we are living in, or is it just me that is disgusted by the abuse and militarization of the police force? Ms. Ernst, 30 seconds.
Well, I do believe that government infringes on people's rights a number of times, and we do have a police force that seems to be much more military, and it is an issue maybe in some communities. I don't have a specific example that this person has given, but I do believe that government needs to back out of our lives. As long as we are lawful, legal, law-abiding citizens, the government should keep its hands off.
Congressman Braley, 30 seconds.
Well, I share some of those concerns with Senator Ernst, but we also know that laws are set up for people who break the rules, not for people who follow the rules. And I am concerned that we're moving away from what we know has historically been the most effective form of policing. That's being out and engaged in the community, knowing the people that you're trying to help understand the importance of following the rule of law. That's what we need to get back to, is community policing, where you connect with the people in your community.
Thank you both. And now to our closing statements. A coin flip has established the order of which. Congressman Braley, you will begin. Each of you will have 90 seconds for closing arguments.
Well, thank you, Gary. And I've already talked about the fact that my ancestors from Ireland are buried right across the river in Coal Valley. They went to Iowa looking to start a farm and looking for a better way of life. My dad was born on that farm, and he's buried nearby. He left that farm when he was 17, enlisted in the Marine Corps, served on Iwo Jima, and came back, fell in love with my mother. They settled down in a small town called Brooklyn. That's where I learned Iowa values, around the kitchen table. I met my wife, Carolyn, at an Eagles concert at Iowa State. We've been married for 30 years. We have three wonderful children, and we're very lucky. And I want to thank them for being so supportive of me and everything that I've done in my life. But I also believe that you have to be able to work with anyone who has a good idea that's good for Iowa. I'm a bridge builder, not a bridge burner. And Senator Ernst and I have very different visions about the future of Iowa. I stand with 300,000 Iowans who deserve a pay raise by increasing the minimum wage. I stand with 220,000 Iowa college students who would see their interest rates skyrocket under Senator Ernst's plan to get the government out of student loans. I stand with millions of Iowans who pay into Social Security every day and would have their benefits jeopardized by Senator Ernst's plan to privatize Social Security and change Medicare as we know it. I'm here tonight to ask for your vote and to tell you that I will never forget my job as Iowa's next senator.
Senator Ernst.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody, and thank you for allowing us to be here this evening. Thank you, Congressman, for joining me on the stage. You have seen clear differences tonight in this race. I'm not a Washington politician. I grew up on a family farm in southwest Iowa, and I am a mother, I am a soldier, and I am an independent leader who cares greatly about the nation that we are leaving our children. I disagree almost completely with Congressman Braley and President Barack Obama on just about everything, spending, taxes, Obamacare, amnesty, and the list goes on and on. Congressman Braley has a failed record in D.C., and so he's running the most negative campaign Iowans have ever seen. But I believe in the Iowa way. I believe Iowans know what's best for Iowa more than politicians in Washington, D.C. And if you trust me with your vote on November 4th, I will fight so that more of our middle-class families have good-paying jobs. I will fight so that those thousands of Iowans who are facing higher health care costs because of Obamacare, so we can get them good, affordable health care. And I will fight for our seniors like my mom and dad that are on Social Security and Medicare, making sure that they are receiving their benefits because their generation has sacrificed so much so that we can achieve that American dream. And as your next United States Senator, I will fight to make sure more Americans can achieve that dream.
I would like to thank you both for a very insightful and spirited debate. We're on KWTC.com. Now you can really applaud if you'd like to.
You are watching live coverage on C-SPAN. C-SPAN's campaign 2014 is bringing you more than 100 debates for the control of Congress. Stay in touch with our coverage and engage. Follow us on Twitter at C-SPAN and like us at facebook.com/C-SPAN. Here are some comments. Judy says, if Ernst wins Iowa, you can thank the Koch brothers for destroying your state. Samuel, where's the third party? Can't take a debate between only two parties anymore. I want more voices and more choices. Linda writes, Braley threw the first punch and she laid him out flat. Gary says, is it November yet? You can follow us on Twitter at C-SPAN and like us at facebook.com/C-SPAN.
C-SPAN's 2015 Student Cam competition is underway. This nationwide competition for middle and high school students will award 150 prizes totaling $100,000. Create a 5 to 7 minute documentary on the topic, The Three Branches and You. Videos need to include C-SPAN programming, show varying points of view, and must be submitted by January 20th, 2015. Go to studentcam.org for more information. Grab a camera and get started today.
Next, former Secretary of State Colin Powell talks about foreign policy issues and the use of troops to contain the Ebola outbreak in Africa. After that, a Defense Department panel reviews the military judicial process for sexual assaults. Then, another chance to see a debate in the U.S. Senate race in Iowa. Now, former Secretary of State Colin Powell discusses foreign policy and the U.S. approach to handling the situation in Iraq and Syria. He also comments on the use of the military in West Africa to help contain the Ebola virus. Colin Powell was also Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair under Presidents George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, and served as National Security Advisor to President Ronald Reagan. This event was hosted by the World Affairs Council. This is about 40 minutes.
How about that?
Good.
That's good. All right. Thank you very much. The joke was, I'd never heard this phrase, the voice of God, before, but I was glad to see the voice of God turned out to be a woman. It was excellent, I thought, when it came out. I just want to welcome you all here, and I want to, first of all, say thank you to Carol Sisko. Thank you for helping us with this event, for sponsoring this event, and thank you for those very personal words that you gave. And if you'd allow me kind of one in turn, when I joined the Foreign Service, a young officer, Ambassador Sisko was the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. And I can remember being given a job at one point to take a piece of paper up to the Undersecretary. It was urgent. And I was told to get this piece of paper to Joe Sisko. So I got up there on the seventh floor, and I ran down the corridor in front of the Secretary's office, the Deputy Secretary's office, and the Undersecretary's office. And finally, someone stepped out and grabbed me by the arm and said, "Don't ever run in this corridor again." I can tell you that 25 years later, when General Powell gave me the opportunity to be the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, I ran down that corridor all the time. I want to join in thanking the sponsors. My plan for today is to engage General Powell in a conversation. As you can imagine, there are a certain number of things that were true at the State Department. One was that General Powell truly needs no introduction. But I would say that along the list of things that you read in your program, he's also a great teacher. And for me, what he taught us was that you can do great things and still be a good human being, that the people matter, and that optimism is a force multiplier. And those are lessons that I have taken with me for the rest of my life. I also want to say that I had the good fortune to watch a program. General Powell went back to Foreign Service Institute the other day, and Nancy McEldowney, the director of the Foreign Service Institute, is here along with some of her students. And I was struck by the reception that General Powell was given at that event by people who recognized what he had done for the State Department and for the Foreign Service and for the Civil Service. And I know we have here the winners, two winners from an A100 class leadership award. We thank you very much for being here. And that leadership imbibed came from General Powell, and so I appreciate that very much. We'll get to today's events, I'm sure. We'll take cards from the audience. But we thought we might just step back for a minute and think a little bit about the larger questions of America as an indispensable power and what life will be like going forward, not necessarily looking back. But first, I have to ask this question. I couldn't resist, which is, after your 4 years at the State Department, and I got so used to calling you Secretary Powell, when you went back to private life, General Powell again, I have to ask why.
The reason is very simple. It's a protocol. You are a secretary for the time you're in office, and when you leave, you become a former secretary. You never become a former general. Also, it's what most people remembered me as from my military career, and I was an Army officer for 35 years before I had the privilege of being the Secretary of State. But it was interesting. On my first day at the Department of State, somebody came in late in the afternoon and said to me, "General, or Mr. Secretary, here's a question. What do we call you? Is it General or Mr. Secretary?" I said, "As long as I'm here, it's Mr. Secretary, and you are my troops, and that's how we will operate for the next 4 years, or however long it is." Got it? Yes, sir. There was a lot of concern in the department when I came in, and then Rich Armitage came in with me as Deputy Secretary, and Grant Green came in, and And Vinnie Kelly, my legislative affairs guy, was a Marine. And it looked like the Pentagon had finally succeeded in its ultimate wish to take over the State Department. But I think we demonstrated to the department that we were here to do the best we could for the department and that we weren't taking over. We were here to be partners.
Good. Thank you very much. One of the things that I was always struck in our conversations and in your writing and other things that you have said is the importance that you gave to diplomacy, but diplomacy backed by force. Now, the diplomacy without force is just sort of walking around.
They are linked. It's all part of, as some of my colleagues like to say, the tool bag that's available. And so I've always felt strongly that you should try to solve conflicts in this world through negotiations, through diplomacy. Anytime we can solve a problem that way and not use force and satisfy our objectives, let's push for that. But force always has to be available. It has to be in the corner. I don't think we need to advertise it. Everybody knows we have it. Everybody knows what we can do. And it's also been my experience in my career that when diplomacy has not worked, and when it was necessary to use military force to achieve a political purpose, that we did it, and we did it in a decisive manner, and make sure that we understood what we were getting into, we understood the political objective that we were trying to achieve, and we tried to bring the conflict to a resolution as quickly as we possibly could, using decisive force, and then get back to peacemaking, get back to diplomacy.
And do you think that those linkages are well made today, that's something that, I mean, you're in front of a group here, of course, that is interested in foreign affairs, that studies these things. But as you go out to the rest of the country, is that linkage something that's well understood, you think?
I think the American people understand it instinctively because it's commonsensical. It's not always applied throughout all of the history of the United States. In my experience, I had a couple of operations that clearly were, you know, met that standard. When we invaded Panama in December of 1989, there was a particular reason to do it, and the original plan was just to remove Noriega. Those of you who remember my good friend, General Noriega. But when the instant came to do it, my recommendation to President Bush and with Secretary Cheney's support was not just remove Noriega, remove the entire Panamanian Defense Force and start fresh. And we had a president in hiding in Panama. And so we went in with a force of 28,000, which is far more than you needed to take out Noriega, but it did the trick. And we have now seen multiple peaceful, democratic elections take place in Panama over the last 20-odd years, and there isn't a single American soldier serving in Panama any longer. Same thing with Desert Storm. We were criticized at one point for, why didn't you go to Baghdad? Well, that was never the mission. The mission assigned by the president, supported by the Congress, endorsed by the United Nations and supported by almost every country in the world but a couple, was to kick the Iraqi army out of Kuwait. Clear mission, defined precisely, and President Bush gave us all the force that we thought was necessary to accomplish that mission. And it was an operation where we were all set to go. I was able to say to the president, I'm guaranteeing the outcome. We saw that the Iraqi army was essentially trapped in the desert, not moving. We knew how to go around them, and we were going to make sure that we had a decisive amount of force, and that worked. You don't always get that set up. Things can become much more difficult as they are now, as we deal with the situation in Afghanistan, Iraq, and now the new element of ISIL coming into Iraq and also having a very strong presence in Syria as well and creating problems throughout the region. It's a little harder to single out a political objective that the achievement of which will solve all the problems. And it's a little difficult to figure out how to apply force in a way that is supported by the American people, that has the support of our Congress, the support of the international community. And I think we're still trying to find our way through that right now. The president has decided that air power is the weapon of choice for the moment, and he's put together a coalition to do that. But I'm an infantry officer, and I know that sooner or later, if you want to prevail and apply decisive force, you've got to go in on the ground. The ground has to be taken. The enemy has to know you have lost. And that force is going to have to be the Iraqi army. And it's going to have to be an Iraqi army that has the will to fight and that has a government that has given them the will to fight, given them the means to fight, and has also done the diplomacy to try to bring together the different elements of Iraqi society behind this effort to prevail. An army can be well-equipped, it can be well-trained, but if it doesn't have the will to fight because it doesn't believe in the government that has sent it to the war, you have a problem. That's the principal thing that has to be fixed right now. Restore the capability of the Iraqi army, but make sure that they have the will to fight, and that will has to derive from the political leadership of the authorities in Baghdad.
Thank you. I'm interested also in another application of force in the contemporary world. You laid out your criteria, thinking about how to use the army, use military force. How do you feel about the decision to send 3,000 troops and perhaps more now to deal with Ebola?
During my time as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and in other military assignments as commander of Army forces in the United States, we found issues like that would pop up frequently. A riot in Los Angeles, and suddenly the Army is called upon with the Marines to go do something about it. Hurricanes in Florida that wiped out huge sections of South Florida, and the military is called upon to deal with that. So it is not out of the usual run of things the military has to do. This one's a little different because it is in a faraway place, and it is a disease that we really don't quite have a handle on yet. But what is wonderful about our military force is that they are so adaptable. They are so successful in organizing logistics. Nobody can move like we can move logistically and move forces around. So I don't think this is an unreasonable mission to give the armed forces of the United States, as long as they are working with health organizations from around the world, and especially from the United Nations. And we have to make sure that as we send these young people over there, we're protecting them from the very disease they're going over to help other people stay away from and to be removed from future harm and be put in isolation. And that's going to take time, and it's going to take a long while before this disease hopefully runs its course. But yes, it's the kind of mission that comes along. It has nothing to do with using force per se. It has nothing to do with a political objective. It's a humanitarian objective. It's the same thing we started to do in Somalia in the last month of the Bush 41 administration. We stopped the starving and the lack of supplies for the people, but then we stayed too long, got caught up in another one of these, let's make this place a nice democracy, and the mission did not turn out the way we thought it would, and hopefully now Somalia is in a better place, but that's 20 years later.
This morning when you and I were communicating a little bit, we both noticed, and I'm sure all the audience did, there was a very interesting kind of special section in the New York Times today about energy. And one of the things that I know in your private life, and interests me as well, is the United States, after having a revolution in energy, is in a completely different place than it was 10 years ago, even 15 years ago. And that the United States, as this piece of paper talked about to become an energy power in this world again. And I wonder from your perspective, if you think about your time as National Security Advisor, Secretary of State, the people who hold those jobs now, when they go in to see the President of the United States and they say, Mr. President, you've got options that your immediate predecessors didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think it'll affect our foreign policy?
I think it will affect our foreign policy very significantly. I mean, we are now going to become a major exporter of fossil-based energy. And there are a lot of discussions taking place as to whether we should remove the restrictions on exporting crude oil out of the country. These are restrictions that were put in place, by the way, initially back in 1973 when we were going through the Arab oil crisis. And it's not really relevant. That needs to be restudied. And I don't see why we shouldn't be exporting a commodity that for which there is a demand and a demand that we can supply. A lot of debate about the XL pipeline, you know, phase four of that whole project. All of that will be worked out because it's important for us with our southern and northern neighbors, Canada and Mexico, to be seen as an energy exporter to the rest of the world. But we have to be very, very careful that we don't think it's a weapon of some kind that we're going to use against some of our Middle Eastern friends. They will still be exporting. And oil is a fungible thing. It goes all around the world in different ways, and we have to see it that way. And the last thing I want to do is to see that we're using energy in a way that is not in the interest of the friends who have been with us for all these years providing us oil. But the whole thing's going to change. But I also think, based on other activities I'm involved in, is that while we are enhancing our ability to use natural gas and oil in its many new dimensions, let's continue working on clean energy. Let's continue to work on solar. Let's continue to work on wind. I'm in a company called Bloom Energy, and we are developing solid oxide fuel cells. One could fit on this platform right now, and you put natural gas in one end, and electricity comes out the other end, and there's absolutely no emissions coming out, no very little noise coming out, very clean energy. So we need to find ways to have clean energy. I'm also a great believer that nuclear power has a role to play in solving the energy problem. And when you're thinking about energy, then you also have to think about all of these options, and you also have to think about what is it doing to the environment. You don't talk about energy without thinking about what it's doing to the environment. And this is especially a case in China and a real problem for China. They need energy, and they have to have it. So they're building coal-fired plants, oil-fired plants, nuclear, wind. They're using everything in order to satisfy their energy needs. The one thing in this energy transformation which is going to change our economy, it's going to change our relations with other countries, but the one thing you don't hear much about is the demand for energy is also increasing at a rapid rate. China has 800 million people who have not yet benefited from the economic miracle that has been China for the last 40 years, and they want to know when's our turn. And their turn will come when the Chinese find new industries to put them in and to get them off the farms. They don't need that many farmers. And as China develops new factories and continues to go through an industrial revolution, guess what they need to do that? Energy. And so we have to make sure while we're looking at the new sources we have and the new opportunities we have, where the demand is and how can we satisfy the demand in the cleanest possible way.
You give me a nice and easy segue to my next topic, which was that...
Yeah, I'll bet.
which was that certainly my early memories of the time you were Secretary of State, dominated by China and the P3 incident, as you will recall even better than I will. I was interested in kind of where you thought this pivot or rebalance to Asia was going on. I mean, here we are, the world is filled every day, you know, what's going on in Iceland, what's going on in the Middle East, and all that's really important. But as you say, there's China out there. And I wondered, rebalance, pivot, and also very importantly is your experience tells you kind of how the United States is seen credibly by our treaty allies in Asia. Very important as well.
I hate the term rebalance. I hate the term pivot. I hate the term reset. I have always objected to these one-word cliches that are supposed to capture a very sophisticated relationship between a couple of nations. And my own experience with China goes back 42 years now, when I was a young lieutenant colonel, a White House fellow, and I was allowed to travel in China for 3 weeks. One of the first American military officers allowed in China since the 1949 revolution. And it was right after the Cultural Revolution in China that I was there and saw these people and saw how desperate they were to get ahead, to join the world that was moving forward. And I've watched for the last 40 years as China has come up and become the second largest economy in the world, but still with a totalitarian form of government. They haven't changed, and they're not going to change that. But what I tried to do as National Security Advisor, as Chairman, and as Secretary of State is to deal with the Chinese in a respectful manner as a country that is emerging, a country that is demanding more of a say in Asia, and that is not unreasonable, a country that is investing in its military as we invest in our military, and a country that is holding $1.5 trillion worth of our paper. I say, it's a great deal for everybody. China makes products. They send the products to Walmart. Walmart sells all that stuff and sends the profit back to China, and then China lends us the money that they just got from Walmart. These guys are good. I mean, that is really good. But that's the nature of the international economic system that we are in. And so when you say you're going to pivot, it means you're turning towards something, but it also means you're turning away from something. And so when we pivoted to Asia, the Chinese immediately saw it as, hey, they're pivoting toward us. They're coming after us. And all our other friends, particularly in Europe and in the Middle East, said, uh-oh, America doesn't care as much about us as they used to. And so those kinds of terms don't seem to be very, very useful. But I think what we need with China is a mature relationship. We have to speak to them candidly about human rights. We have to speak to them candidly about hacking and other problems that we have with them. But at the same time, they need us, and we need them. in a good economic relationship that is also a good political relationship, even if we disagree with a lot of their policies. One of the things we have to learn in this new world, this post-Cold War world, is that not everybody is ready to follow our lead just because we ask them to or we want them to, like we might have been able to do during the Cold War. We have to realize that the most important thing we can do for our foreign policy interests now is to fix things that are wrong here in the United States of America, to work hard in our infrastructure, to work hard in our education, to do something about a Congress that is totally constipated, if I can use a rather odd term. It's getting nothing done. And people are watching. People are saying, that's the model, eh? Is that what Jeffersonian democracy is about, they keep telling us about? What are we going to do about the fact that we have more people in jail than any other nation that faces the earth, totally and by capita? What are we going to do about Guantanamo, which I've been pushing to close for the last 12 years, in office and out? Not that these folks are good, but it turns out that the federal courts are throwing more terrorists in jail every day than we ever got thrown in jail from Guantanamo. And it is a weight around us as we try to make a moral cause about our country to the rest of the world. So we really have to focus on our economy, our education, our infrastructure, and our economic base. You know, we are coming out of a bad situation that began in 2008 economically, but at the same time, not all of our fellow citizens are sharing in the recovery, and that has to be a priority. Everybody in this room is doing well, but I can take you one block from here and show you people who are not doing as well and don't have the same confidence in the economy as we do. We also have to make sure that we have a healthcare system that benefits everybody. I'm not supporting any particular healthcare system. I don't know enough about it. All I know is that I've had nice socialized medicine from the United States Army for the last 56 years. Works fine. I'm not suggesting everybody get military healthcare, but I'm saying to you, with all the money we spend on healthcare and the needs of our citizens, we should have universal healthcare for everybody. And I would wish that our Congress in due course would start to make whatever fixes they want into the Affordable Health Care Act, but realize that we have people desperately in need of proper health care and make sure that all of our citizens, everyone, to include 6 million children who are uninsured, get that kind of health care. And so, not drifting too far off the subject of the question, I feel that there's a lot that we can do with respect to reassuring our treaty allies. There's a lot we can do with respect to fixing our own economy so that once again we can be, you know, a light that shines before the rest of the world to illuminate the world. I don't use terms like we are indispensable or we're number one. It means that somebody isn't indispensable, you know, is lesser. So I think we have to sometimes speak with a little more humility. People know who we are. They know our strength. They know our economic strength. They know our political strength. And they know our military strength. So I think we don't have to advertise it as strongly as we sometimes do. I'll let your light so shine before you, if I can slip slightly into biblical references.
Let me follow up with that, because one of these I've been most interested in, you've been kind enough to send me from time to time information on the Powell School at City College of New York. And it speaks exactly to these questions, education. Yeah. Diversity. Who's the next round of leaders in the United States? And I think people would benefit from hearing a little bit about the school.
Well, I can tell you by the year 2040 or so, the next set of leaders in the nation are going to be brownish. In another 30 years, the majority of Americans will be those we call minorities now. It will be Hispanics, Asian Americans, and African Americans. And so my life, the passion in my life now with the America's Promise Alliance that was made a reference to earlier and what I'm doing in different schools around the country, but especially in my school in Harlem. I graduated from City College of New York, which is in Harlem. It's about a mile from where I was born. And it's been amusing over the years to have people come up to me and say, well, General Powell, you're chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. When did you graduate from West Point? Couldn't have gotten in. Not like those wonderful middies up there who got into academies. Good to see you guys. And I say, couldn't have gotten in. It was impossible. It was above my possibility to aspire to get into West Point. Just a little kid in the corner in South Bronx. And well, did you go to the Citadel or VMI? I said, no, when I was entering college, they wouldn't allow black folks to go to those schools. So I went to City College of New York, and I got a quality education, discovered ROTC at City College, and that became my career path, going into the military, because my academic record didn't suggest I was going anywhere else. In fact, I almost didn't get out. I was hanging around a long time, and they got worried about me, and they finally decided to take my A's, straight A's in ROTC, roll it into my grade point average, bring me up to 2.0, and get me out of here. And they did it with great fanfare. Really, get him into the Army, we'll never see him again. But now I'm back, and when I left the State Department, when I stepped down from the State Department a few weeks later, I knew there was a small center at CCNY that had been named after me. And I went up there to see what was going on. And I sat in the president's conference room, and they brought in about 12 students who were in my center. And they were all minority. Most were immigrants. Most were from somewhere else. And they started telling me their stories. And it was the American story repeated over and over and over again. And these kids came from poor families. There are no legacy students in my school because none of their parents went to college. And I don't want any legacy students coming back. We're going to go and educate the kids who are most in need. And when I heard their stories, I said, I got to get, this is where I belong. I'm home again, back in Harlem, back at CCNY, and this is where I'll work. After a few years, the school decided to, the college decided to make an entire school of the college named after me, the Colin Powell School for Civic and Global Leadership. And our focus is on leadership training and on service, so that what they study in their academic department is what they also do in the community as they perform service. And these youngsters are going to be the leaders. And what's so fascinating about them is they're not fooling around. They come from immigrant families. They're poor. Most of them are working. Some of them have families. They're hungry. And they come to school, and we don't fool around up there. And so I'm very proud of that, because it gives me the chance not just to stay here in the present and talk about present issues, but allows me to participate in the future, because they are the future of our country. It also allows me to, if I can take one more second on this, Mark, I get asked all the time, you know, well, how are we doing? Aren't we, you know, are we in real trouble? And I say, we have lots of problems. Shimon Peres said to me right after the Cold War was over, former president of Israel, a great friend of us, everybody in this room, and we were kind of musing at the situation in the post-Soviet world, and he put his arm around me and said, Colin, oi, yeah, we've lost all our enemies, now all we have are problems. Well, we found some enemies. We had to go find them, too. But what he was saying is the world that you're looking at now is a world with lots of problems. But when you step back, America is under no existential threat to our existence the way it was during the Cold War. Our major interest should be with places like China, 1.3 billion people, India, 1.3 billion people, Latin America, several hundred million, Europe, several hundred million, and focus on the problems. Do everything we can to solve those problems, but remember, that is not the whole world. And what the American people are saying as I travel around the country and doing business and giving speeches is that they understand the need for us to deal with these problems, but first and foremost, let's make sure we're fixing the United States, and that'll be the greatest thing we can contribute to our foreign policy as we try to help others in the world and solve all the problems in the world.
Thank you. I've got two more questions, one from me and one thank you very much from the midshipmen who are here. Thank you all. I've got to try to combine your questions into one, if you would allow me. I acknowledge here right in front of us a number of serving Foreign Service officers, and of course we have a number of retired officers in the room from American Academy of Diplomacy and World Affairs Councils of America. I just wanted to take you back, if I could, to the time when you became the Secretary of State. And I remember very clearly how proud we were of the effort that you made to bring the Foreign Service, the Civil Service, and locally engaged staff, not to homogenize them, but to bring them together to fight and to work as one team.
Yeah.
And when I think back on that time, it's something that I find to be a very admirable thing. I know there are people now who think that this has all been taken too far and that everybody wants to be the same. I wonder if you look back 9 years, sort of how you feel about all that.
Well, when I came into the department, I was handed a bunch of studies and reports of things that needed to be fixed. And I started to work on that. And I also even got a report that a lot of you will remember called SOS, Save Our State, which was a very troubling report to receive on your first day. But as I looked around the building and got to know the various followers that I had in the Department of State,